and we did it, and he tweeted it out, and he went from 20,000 followers to, I think, close to 100,000 followers at this point in 24 hours. Andrew, hey, what's guys. Going on?
The return of Andrew. We promised, we promised that you would come back. And sometimes that's just something we say where we're like, oh, we got to do this again sometime. But this was a real one. So we're like, all right, when do you want to do it?
Yeah, I feel we had 20 things to get through. We got through like four.
So what do you guys say we also bullshit around this time and not address half of the topics again and set it up for a third parter?
I do want to bullshit one thing. And this kind, maybe Andrew, you'll know a little bit about this. But listen, let me tell you guys a story really quick. Andrew, do you know a guy named Chris Pronger?
No.
He is a hockey player. He played in the NHL for like 20 years or something. He is from Canada, I think Ontario. And he played in St. Louis Blues. He's like the fifth or sixth or seventh highest paid player of all time. So for some reason, he reached out to me on Twitter and I started talking to him. And then we went and got dinner and he's like, hey, tell me how this Twitter thing works. Like, it looks cool. Like, should I try this? I was like, yeah, dude, here's what we're going to do. Tomorrow, call me on Zoom. And the day before you call me, send me five titles of what you think a tweet could be. And we'll just sit and I'll just kind of like write while you talk and I'll just find the interesting stuff that you're saying and we'll go from there. And we did it and he tweeted it out and he went from 20,000 followers to I think close to 100,000 followers at this point in 24 hours. And the tweet was read by 10 million people and got 30 something thousand likes. And this is the fifth time I've done this. So I did this with my friend Ramon. And he got featured in all this. He got on the How I Built This podcast and Business Letter because of that. I did it with my friend Val, who same thing. We did it with, I helped do it with my friend Anthony, who talked. Do you guys see the tweet thread about him living in Africa and eating like only meat with like the tribe he was staying with? Anyway, this is crazy. If you just take interesting people, and it's not like I did any of the work. They were just talking their stories. And I just helped them write it. It's pretty wild how this game works.
And what were the stories? What did you share?
Chris's was easy. It was let me tell you one of them
because it got picked up by Bro Bible. So the Bro Bible headline.
Oh, did
is,
it really?
Ex NHL star Chris Pronger shares traps that pro athletes fall into, including spending $1 million at a strip club. And how did it get so much traffic right away? I think because the story got picked up by bigger outlets like Bro Bible too, so that adds a lot of fuel to the fire.
It's hilarious, yeah. And I retweeted it early on, but I think it's just like he's already somewhat famous and cool, and like I think sometimes they like I'm not trying to say this to brag because the reality is like it's not that hard because the guy's already like a big deal and has an interesting life and like. Who's if you earned $100 million,
dude? He's not that big of a deal.
Like, well, but I mean, is
not but, that many people know Chris Pronger.
But what I mean is, if you earn $100 million as a professional athlete, you have like one. You have there's only 1,000. There's only 100 people who have that insight that you have. So, right. Like the insights that are
I wonder
already
what
there.
You, like, if you think about the value, you think about the value of what you did for him. That's insane. Like, if you went to someone and said, hey, I'm going to get you 10 million impressions on a tweet, or I'm going to get you 100,000 followers. What's that worth? People pay like, that's like, honestly, I'd say that's like $1 million tweet or something that you gave him.
Well, yeah, but you can't guarantee that, right? So it's like a hard service to sell.
Oh, dude, you should do it right here, right now. You should say, I will write tweets for you, but depending on the outcome and the number of followers, you have to pay me a certain amount. So it's totally variable.
Yeah,
that would actually be worth your time.
So, Andrew, I was on a Twitter Spaces with Logan Paul. I was talking to Logan Paul this morning.
Oh, no way.
So you're only the second most famous person I've talked to this morning.
Dude, only a little bit more famous. Holy crap, that's crazy. What's he doing these days?
He just launched a marketplace, like a fractional ownership NFT thing. So he basically created this thing called Liquid Marketplace, where like. I don't know if you've seen, but he's really into Pokemon cards, like Charizard cards and stuff like that. Like that's been his thing over the last few years, is like these collectible either sports cards or Pokemon cards. And so what he did today was he launched a fractional, like a Rally Road style marketplace, where he would put up, like, you know, his Charizard card, and you could just buy like a share of it, rather than he bought the thing for $2 million and you could buy, you know, a piece of the pie there. So that's what he launched today. So that's why he was kind of doing like a promotional thing. And I was like, all right, I'll just shoot my shot. And so I just, like, you know, raised my hand or whatever and went and talked to him.
When was that?
It's crazy the power of the moat of a personal brand and a following, right? Like, those guys, they could build 100 businesses off of their following. And that Chris Pronger guy, the reason that's so valuable is he can now start his own business doing whatever he wants, selling shirts, selling NFTs, starting a consulting business, managing money for other hockey players, you know, whatever, off of that 100,000 people. The optionality of it is insane. Obviously, the downside of it is if you're Logan Paul, you're Logan Paul, and you've ultimately got to be the face.
Did you, did you just say, Sean, that Sam, you...
I was telling him.
Go ahead.
Sorry, we've got a little delay. I was just telling Andrew, I talked to Logan Paul this morning. That was the
on the phone or in front of people?
The door. In front of people, on a Twitter Spaces, just randomly.
I saw that. I was listening, but I didn't. His name on Twitter is not. I think it had a nickname on it, so I couldn't tell if it was Logan. Was he cool?
Yeah, he was cool. I mean, he was like promoting his thing, which is, you know, that's why he was on there, like, because he launched a new like Rally Road competitor, basically, and so I was just joking around with him, basically. That
I know you guys covered it in the Milk Road.
A couple different things. But that personal brand thing, Andrew, you kind of got that early on because you built your personal brand back, I think, before a lot of people were doing it. Cause you kind of built it, I would say, pre-Twitter even. Was that right? Like, did you kind of have a blog following before Twitter, or was it all on Twitter?
Yeah, I had a blog and stuff, but honestly, like, we were pretty quiet until COVID, and then during COVID, I was bored and lonely and wanted to talk to people. And so going on podcasts was like a way to socialize. And then I realized the power of it. Like, once I started getting, 30,000, 40,000 Twitter followers, I realized that when I talked about a business I was incubating, I had our first 1,000 customers in a split second. And so from my perspective, you know, I talked about last time about being like the Dust Bowl farmer mindset of what if you lose everything. There's such power in that. You could literally go bankrupt. You could lose all your businesses. You could reboot in 2 days with a business idea if you have a Twitter following. And no one can take your Twitter following away, obviously.
Dude, you were not low-key before Twitter.
You were famous before that.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, no. I'm saying, like, I wasn't on a single major podcast, and I was well known. Like, when I went to South by Southwest, there'd be people all the time recognizing me from Twitter, but that was a very small nerdy community or whatever. So I was well known within like the design community, but that was it.
All right. Well, whatever you say. I feel like before COVID, we had you on the podcast, and it was already one of the more popular podcasts because you were on it, and people already knew your story. So I don't know. I feel like you might be the timeline in your head might be a little bit different than kind of at least the way I perceived it, which was you were famous. You were famous when we started the podcast.
Yes.
And we started the podcast before COVID. So
that's so weird. Yeah. My perception is like all of it has just been the last 3 years or whatever.
Can
like
I give you guys
a saying is true that like your personal brand does like kind of give you, it's a door that opens more doors. But the downside is you have to say to yourself, I'm building my personal brand, which is one of the lamest statements you could say. So, you know, if you can live with that, if you can sleep with that at night, then it works out for you. I know that it's hard for me and Sam to do that.
Can we give you...
Well, that's kind of why I haven't started my own podcast or consistently tweeted or anything, right? To be honest, I'm hacking your audience, right? I'll come on here once in a while when I have things to say, but I don't want to have to always come on and always tweet. And when I was tweeting consistently, I was driving myself crazy because I was constantly going like, okay, what's my big tweet today?
Can we, let me give you guys an update on the pod. I don't know if I told you this, Sean, or you, Andrew. So, and then we'll get into Andrew's stuff. When we first started, I think I told Sean or he told me, I was like, let's just get to 100,000 downloads an episode. And I bet we can do that. So Sean, we are now not consistently for all episodes, but they just told me that a couple of our episodes are now getting over 100,000 downloads, which is like it's pretty good.
Wow. That's dope. Oh, that's sweet. Been the goal for a while. Like, I feel like that's been the North Star of what would it mean to like kind of make it in podcasting. It was like, if we could do it where 100,000 downloads per episode, because everybody else bullshits, like, and we do this too, like, we get this many million monthly downloads a month, but it's like, yeah, you just pump out volume and, like, you know, great. The only test that really matters for podcasts, how many listens per episode do you get? That's like the best metric you can get. And I remember we were saying the 100,000 number back when we had like under, I feel like a slightly under 10,000 per episode at that time. That's when I first kind of put that out there. And then it's just been like climbing since then. That's kind of crazy that it even happened without us. Like, it's kind of like when I looked away from it and stopped paying attention to it, like, sure enough, compounding just worked and it like got there, you know, without me really having to stress it.
In January, one of the last couple months, we crossed 2 million downloads per month. That year prior, that same time, I think was 500,000. And so my prediction is I think we can get hit 3 million by December. I've got no math or anything behind that, but I think that seems like it could happen. So anyway, just want to give you an update on that.
What's like the biggest podcast do? What's Tim Ferriss do per episode? Do you know?
I have to imagine he's in the 500,000 to million range.
I think he's probably even a little bit higher than that. I know that Bill Simmons or Joe Rogan, I forgot which one it was I was looking to at the time. They're two of the biggest. I remember they were getting like 3 or 4 million downloads per episode. I think it was Bill Simmons at the time. 3 or 4 million downloads per episode is what he was getting. And he was consistently in the top five podcasts.
You know
what
you should do? You should track, though. Think about like, so Tim Ferriss has been podcasting for what, 8 or 9 years or whatever. And that's how long it took him to get to that scale. You guys might actually be growing faster than Tim Ferriss if you chart it out.
Well, I'm already over six feet, so I did outgrow him a while back.
Got him. Nice. You're a dad. You're a dad.
All right. Let's do some of these topics. You got a bunch on here. I'm just going to say them out loud. And I have no idea what these mean, but I'll just pick the ones that sounds most interesting to me.
Well, we were having a text thread. We were kind of texting about the idea of getting rich fast versus getting rich slow, taking a big swing versus doing something boring.
Dude, I forgot. Kind of I thought that was on the podcast.
No, that was a text message. We should do that. Andrew, can you frame it? Because I think you had a good take, and I'm also going to give you the advantage of frame the debate a little bit what is the debate here?
So I think anyone who's in the tech world, generally you read headlines about people who swung big and they won big, like Jeff Bezos. And I always say, for every Jeff Bezos, there's 100 Jeff Bozos, right? So the guys that tried, they failed, they didn't raise the convertible debt in 1999 that allowed Amazon to survive, or, you know, they timed it slightly wrong, or they were in the wrong market, or whatever it is. And so if you think about it, you know, on one hand, startups are like a house. Like, would you buy a house that had an 80% chance of being worth zero, a 10% chance of making your money back, and had a 10% chance of making you rich, right? And then let's say there's another house, and that house, there's an 80% chance of giving you a pretty solid return, 10% chance of zero, and a 10% chance of a poor return. Which of those houses are you going to buy? And if you think about it, you know, when you start a business, you're really saying, I'm going to put 5 to 15 years of my time into this, right? So I've certainly chosen, you know, the boring house, the 80% chance of solid return, 10% chance of zero, 10% chance of poor return. I'd be curious to know, you know, how you guys think about it.
Sam, you want to go first?
So I think your numbers are, I think your idea is right. The problem that I had when we talked about this was, I think your numbers are wrong. Like the whole 80%, 10%. Now I'm going to let you talk about any numbers that you want to talk about with your life. If you don't want to talk about anything, then don't even bring it up. But let's just say that, so everything I'm saying right now is just made up. Let's just say that you want a business that makes $10 million a year. Okay. Or no, let's say that you want to get a net worth of $50 million by the time you're 50. How much do you think that you would need to make a profit to get a $50 million liquid net worth? How much profit do you think that you would need if you started that business at 30? I would think that you would need a profit.
So I actually
go.
I did the math on this actually before and I wrote it down. So if you have $1 million at age 30 and you can invest, you can produce profits of maybe 300 to 500K a year at between 10 to 12%, you can have $100 million by 60 with compounding.
So, break that down. $1 million, $1 million net worth is your start.
So let's say you have $1 million. Let's say you have $1 million at age 30 and you start a business and that business produces 500K a year. And you just take that 500K a year and you reinvest it and you manage to invest it at about 10%, which is a little above historical market returns. Let's say that you're a good investor. You're a Nick Huber. You're going to just put it in steady Eddie real estate that outperforms a little bit or something.
But there's a flaw.
You can get to $100 million by 60.
Yeah, but there's a flaw here, which is you're assuming that you have zero living expenses.
Sure. Yeah, I'm not really addressing that.
You're just talking about.
I guess the point is the number you need to start with doesn't need to be that big. Like a small number can compound into something staggering if you have a long enough time horizon, especially if you're outperforming. 10%, I think, is quite low compared to what you can earn with skills.
So let's go backwards. So you said 100 million by 60. And I think the trick with most compounding is it all kind of comes to you at the end. The last two cycles, three cycles is where you make all the money. So backtrack. What do you add at 50 and 40 in that world?
I don't know. We don't do public math. I just did the headline.
Well, like
you're your calculator.
You can kind of guess if you're at 100 at 60, you're probably in the range of 50 at 50.
You basically double every 7 years, right? Mm-hmm. At that pace. So you're at
7% doubles every 10 years.
50 million.
Ish. Which is sick. That's right. That's sick. Okay.
Here's the question. So, you know, everyone loves to point at people who are sitting on massive paper gains. Like let's say that Sam started a startup and VCs invested at a $5 billion valuation. In reality, that doesn't mean Sam's a billionaire on paper, but he's not going to realize that until the company IPOs. Maybe he takes a small secondary. Maybe he's got a $10 million, $20 million liquid net worth, but he's really not a liquid billionaire until that company IPOs or sells to somebody. And typically the timeline, even in a tech startup, is 15 years, right? And so my argument is, you know, you can take a big swing with a venture bet, but I mean, statistically, you can argue all you want, but most venture businesses fail, right? At least an 80% failure rate, and maybe 5% at most go on to be something at scale and large, right? So I think what I advocate isn't go uber conservative and go get a salary or go buy a dry cleaner and work there for the rest of your life. It's more what's in the middle, what's the third door? And I like to look at somebody like Nick Huber, who found a niche and he said, look, I'm going to go buy a bunch of self-storage businesses. These are businesses that have been around for 100 years. I have a very specific view on how to make them more profitable. And he knows he can earn between 15 and 40% buying a bunch of those. He just does that for the next 10 years. He's going to be worth hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, I'm actually with you. I think I did this rant on the podcast that nobody liked, which was that you're an idiot if you go for the Olympics. Like going for the Olympics is a trap that, you know, society has tricked you into giving up your entire life to like turn yourself into a human tool that can just, you know, bobsled at 1/10 of a second faster than anybody else. And, you know, people didn't like that because everybody likes the Olympics and we're supposed to honor our athletes and blah, blah, blah. But basically venture-backed startups is the same thing. It's the Olympics of business where you're basically saying, okay, I'm going to swing for this $1 billion prize, which only 0.1% of the startups are going to be able to, you know, like to achieve this type of outcome. And if I miss, I get essentially zero. That's kind of changed nowadays because you get to maybe take secondaries along the way if you make progress. But like a lot of times I would say the average, you know, the median result is essentially zero, or, you know, you've underpaid yourself by 50 to 75% of market salary during those, you know, 7 years 7 to 10 years you spent trying to do it. And you worked way harder and you had a worse lifestyle the whole time. So, you know, like the venture thing is like the Olympics thing. You sacrifice your lifestyle for this very rare and often, like, you know, like at least in the Olympics case, sort of a trivial, you know, here's a piece of metal. You know, at least with startups, if you hit big, you do become a billionaire. So that does pay off. But I kind of think that the venture path is that, and you really only do it for ego is my, like my current understanding of it, which is like, either you do it because it's your calling, meaning you stumbled into a business opportunity or a problem you tried to solve. It just so happens to be that the way this looks is going to be like a winner take all massive, massive business if you do it right. Or you are like, I want to play the Ego Olympics and I want to prove that I am the toughest, smartest, you know, entrepreneur in the world. And so I'm going to go down this path. And like everybody will cheer you on. The media will cheer you on because, hey, what's it to them? You sacrifice yourself for their pleasure. The investors will all cheer you on and call you a hero because what's it to them? They get to go home every day at 4 p.m. and, you know, to their house in Atherton. They don't care, you know, how many hours it takes you for your like low probability of success. They have a portfolio, you know, so really it's the entrepreneur who in some ways I feel gets tricked into it. And I say that as somebody who in many ways was tricked into it. Not by anybody's evil, just by the way that the game is set up. And now I've come to the realization that like more nimble, small, lightweight businesses that provide like a lot of cash flow or businesses that you just buy instead of trying to start a new genius idea from scratch is definitely the way to go from a logical, rational perspective. You could still choose to do the other one because you want to do it. It's more fun to you. But the logic and reasoning is so far on the side of going for a cash flow business that promotes like, you know, gives you an awesome lifestyle from essentially year one, or buying a business that's already working and just using your intelligence to grow it is like a far better path on paper than the venture path. And I say that as somebody who kind of, my natural inkling is to go towards that venture path because it's so sexy.
Well, and also, I mean, it can all go away on the venture path. It can all go away so fast, right? And I think the reason why it's not done as often is people are attracted to get rich quick, right? Nobody wants to get rich slow. And like Sean said, the only way to get rich right now is like someone is in crypto and they're liquid and they have a massive gain. But those stories are so few and far between. If you want to get rich by building a business, even if on paper you're a billionaire in year two, my argument is you're not liquid until 10 years, 15 years anyway. Right. It's very rare that you start a business on year one and in year five, you're a liquid billionaire. And to me, ultimately, liquidity is what matters so often in these things. Right. Either you have cash flow or you can sell your stock or you can use it in some way.
Have you met Michael Acton Smith?
I've heard his name.
He's the co-founder of Calm. But before that, he had, what was the name of his brand? Moshi Monsters, I think it is. It's either Minnow or Moshi Monsters. I think it's Moshi Monsters. So he was in the UK and he created essentially like a Pokemon type of phenomenon. So like, I think Moshi, it was in the UK. It was like this children's kind of like, there was like these characters and then you would like, I don't know, you would like, it was like a game or something like that. It was like this online little world you would go into and do this. And that turned into many things. It was a brand that turned into many things. They slapped those characters on shampoo and started selling it over there. And he dreamed of having a theme park. And, you know, he's a really like big dreamer, big thinker type of guy, super creative. You know, you wouldn't have created that in the first place. This like phenomenon, like a Pokemon or a Digimon or, you know, these brands that just catch fire. I think at one point, like 1 in 3 kids in the UK were playing it. So it was like, you know, just an insane like cultural phenomenon. And it was valued over $1 billion. And he was the fucking man. And he was, you know, he looks like Russell Brand, if you see him. Like, he's just like this, like, kind of like, you know, good looking, like, wait, does this guy have sex in public? He seems like a guy who has sex in public. And it's like, you know, he's got this free love energy. And if you meet him, you're like, yeah, exactly. He's got like, you know, he's got scarves. He's, you know, maximum 2 buttons up on a collared shirt. So like, you know, the guy's walking around with 2 buttons, right? So he's just living his best life. And so he had the persona and then he had the movement to back it up. And it just seemed like this is the type of guy who he's like a Walt Disney type of guy who creates this type of phenomenon. And, you know, Richard Branson loves, everybody loves it. And then sure enough, you know, they kind of got ahead of their skis and all of a sudden, you know, like whatever, third grade came around for those second graders. And they were like, you know what? I don't care about Moshi Monsters anymore. I have moved on to the next thing. And it's like overnight, the business starts losing relevancy. The characters start losing relevancy and like nobody's buying the plush toys and the TV show doesn't want to get made anymore or whatever. They started to unwind essentially. It was very hard for them to like reverse that cycle because, you know, like as fast as you can climb as a like fad phenomenon, that's as fast as it can unwind. And so I don't know exactly what his net worth was, but he was the main guy and the company was worth over $1 billion. I'm sure he was worth hundreds of millions of dollars on paper. but never got to realize it. And then basically had to start back over from scratch as like, you know, just a guy and is, you know, just a guy who's like went through this like roller coaster, but like didn't have the money to show for it, which makes it even more amazing that they, you know, he went and helped seed Calm, like co-found Calm, and then joined Calm and helped grow Calm into like a multi-billion-dollar brand. So he's kind of done it again. And I just think that's amazing.
I had the original agency, and in the early days, the agency barely made any money, but it was a couple $100,000. And I read about the Basecamp guys, you know, doing these SaaS products and stuff. And I was like, man, I want to make money when I sleep. That sounds amazing. And so I started just taking most of my profits and starting, you know, SaaS software companies.
By the way, you said 90-10, right? You put 90% back into the business, into new stuff or whatever. And totally. 10% you lived
in off. The early days, it was probably 80-20, but then over time I ramped it up. So basically I was taking the majority of the profits. Anything I didn't need to live on was almost all going into incubating businesses. I incubated a bunch, and you know, some of those businesses ended up being worth, you know, one I sold for $7 million and was producing 600-700K a year of profit or something like that. So I made a lot of bets with that money, and it ended up compounding into something significant. But then I ended up continuing to take that money and just do the 80-20, 90-10 strategy of always investing. And I really started making a lot more money when I went from starting businesses to buying businesses and investing, which I started about 7 years ago.
Hold on. Those numbers don't make sense.
Yeah.
You said sounds 10 like million in business. Revenue, 20 million in profit.
200% net income. Yeah. Well, no, I mean, no. So it's like, you know, let's say MetaLab's revenue is $1 million. We made 500K of profit. And so that's what's left over at the end after we pay taxes and stuff. I'd take 80% of that 500K and I'd use it to start more businesses, right? And I would just do this on a monthly basis. Whatever was left over in the bank account that I didn't need to run the business, I would go and I'd use it to start yet another business. And I, you know, I've been doing that for 15 years now, and I think, you know, all of our businesses together are worth over $1 billion.
Do you know how much you were compounding? So for example, you took the money and you either started a business or bought a like controlling share in an existing business versus just saying, I'm going to put this into real estate or the stock market or angel invest or whatever. How much additional lift do you think you got? So meaning like at what percent were you compounding by doing the extra work of like identifying and buying businesses and owning them versus like if you had done a more kind of like hands-off strategy, which maybe let's say I think somebody like you could have got 10 to 15% consistently.
I think I could have, if I was passive, I could have got 8 to 12%, right? Putting it in real estate, stocks, that kind of stuff. By buying businesses, you know, there's a lot of advantage in that we could use a little bit of debt because we controlled the whole business, right? So you can get the bank to give you 20 or 30% of it. Which adds a lot of lift on your return. And then we were buying these businesses anywhere from 3 to 10 times earnings. And then we would usually, within the first 2 years, we would find ways to double the business within 1 to 2 years. So you start to think about it and you go, okay, well, that's a kind of 2 to 5 year payback, depending on what's happening. That's based on cash. And then the actual value of the business as you grow the earnings increases over time, right? So the numbers start getting very big very quickly, especially when you've done that, you know, 20 times.
So what do you think was the compounded rate?
Well, I don't know how long they'll last, but it goes back to at the end of the day, you know, when I started, I was making, you know, 200K, 100K a year. And today our businesses make, you know, over $50 million of profit across everything.
So what percent rate do you think you were able to generate? You think you were compounding at like 40%?
I think probably in the end, it's something, or we did the math a couple years ago, because we raised a fund, and I think it was like 40, 40-some%. Now, keep in mind, you know, that was at a time where not that many people were doing what we were doing. So, you know, it's gotten more competitive over time. And those were small deals. It's really easy to compound at high rates when you're doing small deals. As you do bigger ones, I think we'll probably slow down on that. But it's not a number I think about. I you know, I never was like, I want to compound at 44%. I was like, I just want to make my money back in a reasonably safe way. I want to buy great businesses and I want to feel good about what I do.
That's crazy to me because you're Andy Munger. You know, the whole Buffett Munger like philosophy is based on compounding over a long period of time. And the number one variable, I guess, is time, how long you're going to do it for and what's the rate, right? That's like the two
totally
key things.
But even, like, even if you jump, you know, okay, let's drop the rate down to 15% or 10%. It's still hundreds of millions of dollars, right? That's what's crazy about compounding is you don't need to outperform massively. You just need to do, you know, a little better than everybody else. And if you do as well as everyone else, you're still good.
And
all right, let me just ask this question, which was two things. Of your businesses, how many of them do you actually think can last 20, 30, 40 years? And also, if you can buy any company right now, internet related business, what are a handful that you like, that you like, you know, just to give an example to me and Sean, the listener, of like things that you would look for, you know, not actually something you can buy, but something that like, this is what I want, and name a very specific one.
Yeah. So, you know, think about Accenture, right? So Accenture, I forget, it was part of one of the big five consultancies and then it got spun out, but it basically, they help people do like, consulting, strategy, digital transformation, that kind of stuff. That business will definitely exist for the next 30 years. You know, I don't know why it wouldn't. And in the same vein, I think like MetaLab and our agency services businesses, you know, we're really early in every business turning into a tech company, right? Over the next 20 years, more and more companies will have to build software and go digital. And I think there's only so much talent. So I think those are tremendous businesses for the next 20 years. I don't know how to predict over very long times. AeroPress is a business I think will exist in 50 years. You know, I don't see any reason why it wouldn't. Will it have the same competitive advantage as it does today? Will it get a bunch of copycats? Probably. But, you know, Kleenex still exists and it's 100 years later, right? So I don't know. I mean, we also own, I own like a bunch of restaurants and a bakery. And, you know, if people still like their food as they have for the last 30 years, those will probably exist in 30 years. But we do own businesses that they're, you know, platform dependent or, you know, technology dependent, where the seas can change and there's no way to predict how long they can go. But I've been surprised how long some of our businesses have persisted and grown. It just goes back to like, you know, not underestimating anything.
And Andrew, I'm going to give you the devil's advocate to the don't go for the big home run strategy, which is something else I believe is true. I believe it's true that kind of like lifestyle business and a big business, like, you know, a lifestyle business and a moonshot business will both basically take up all of your time. So might as well go big. That's another way of looking at it, right? So for example, I've run a restaurant. I've started a tech company. In both cases, it was on my mind all the time. I was working on it, you know, 5-6 days a week, you know, at minimum, as many hours as I could. I was trying to do it to make it successful. A restaurant was going to be able to spit off, you know, $150,000, $200,000 of profit off that location. And, you know, a tech company could be worth $100 million in 2 years. And so, like, those are just different sizes of the prize for the same level of effort. Probability of success, I would say, you know, you can do better. Restaurant's not a great example because they fail a lot, but like,
let's say dental clinic or something.
Yeah, dental clinic.
If you
did
a dental clinic, you'd probably do great, but you'd have a day job.
Agency or whatever. So probably that's different, but also with a bigger, more ambitious project, you also, every day you get to be more excited about it. You get to recruit better people because their great talent is really excited about it versus like, I know, like, for example, my online course business, I know I could do better if I hire people, but like not everybody wants to come work on that project for, you know, and then I'm going to get somebody who wants just that with, is willing to accept a salary that I can afford. And that's usually not the A-plus person I like to work with. So, you know, you get stuck in that middle zone.
Oh yeah. I'm not advocating for some Tim Ferriss lifestyle work 4 hour work week kind of thing. I think, you know, Warren Buffett is not a lifestyle. He doesn't have a lifestyle business. He has a business he loves to run and he does exactly what he wants to do. But, personally, you know, I like incubating businesses, starting new businesses, getting excited about stuff. I just go, I do that off the side of my desk, right? So that's 20% of my time, 30% of my time. I also like buying great businesses and letting them run and choosing CEOs and doing the Buffett thing. But I need excitement and, you know, all the other stuff. But I'm in no way saying it's any less challenging. I'm just saying your odds of success are higher. And let's be real. If you go to the gym and you try and lift, 800 pounds on your bench on day one, you probably will fail. That doesn't feel very good. But if I give you an 80 pound bench and you lift it, you're going to feel really good about yourself, right? And so I just want to jump over the 1 foot hurdles, right? I want to feel the sense of success. And I think when people start out in tech and they do a startup and they fail and it's brutal, a lot of those people turn around and say, well, I'm never doing that again, when they might have been great entrepreneurs in some other format, right? I just think it's the hardest lift. It's the Olympics, as you said.
Let's do one of these other topics. I'm just going to name it and you give us your riff on it. So doing it wrong before you do it right. What's that?
Yeah. Mean? So I finally put my finger on this because people always criticize me because I'll hire the wrong person, right? I'm a big advocate of if I have an idea and I just want to get moving, I will just go and I'll hire whoever's in front of me and I'll say, hey, let's go do this. And that does not work that well, obviously. But what it does do is it forces you to make it real, right? So, for example, when I know I want to go a direction, I will do this. So I've always loved food and restaurants. I always dreamed of starting my own restaurant. I did. I started my own restaurant. I went and I signed a lease I shouldn't have. I hired the wrong manager. And I lost 800 grand, right? Total learning experience. Here's what it did though. It forced me into that industry. It made me learn it. It made me make a lot of mistakes. And then I found the good people through that. So actually because I was in that restaurant that failed, I met the guy next door who ran a very successful restaurant. And when his partner wanted to sell the steak, I ended up buying it. And now I own this wonderful restaurant. And I know it's good because I've owned a bad restaurant, right? So directionally moving into something. And I think people are way too precious with their hiring. Like they just need to do it and then let people go when it doesn't work out. So that's kind of what I mean by that. Too many people think they're measuring twice, but cutting once, and they just never cut. They just measure forever.
So, but do you just have to fire people all the time?
No, not all the time. I mean, like I've gotten really lucky with lots of these. It's like 50-50, right? The pattern that I've seen, the best thing to do when you're going into a new industry is look for somebody who's actually succeeded within it. The problem is that when you're the rube at the table, when you're the newbie to the industry, even a moron looks like a genius. So that's the hard part, right? And I've certainly made that mistake before.
And you've got this new business called Mailman, right? Mailman, the Gmail plugin.
I've actually had that for a couple of years, but it makes it so that you only get email a couple times a day. So you're not in your inbox all day.
It's picking up steam, it feels like right now. And you met a guy on Twitter who you got to run it, right? Like, that's an example. If you're just like, yeah, whatever, you're an engineer. You seem like you might be able to do this. Just do it.
100%. I'll do this all the time. So I literally, that same year I did it twice. I tweeted out, I said, hey, I've got this idea for a Gmail plugin. I need someone to build it. Who wants to build it? This guy Mohit in India messaged me, sent me a great email. And he said, tell me what you want it to do and I'll have it to you in 48 hours. And he did. And over again, he just kept delivering. There was another business idea I had where I went to the guy, I did the exact same thing and he just didn't make any progress. And so I said, hey, after 3 months, it's not working out, and went a different direction. But, 50% of the time it works really well. And now we not only have Mailman, but we actually started a holding company in India, and we're looking at acquisitions and we've got him managing some of our businesses. So it's been awesome.
That's crazy.
And this kind of like, it feeds into this idea, like I wrote it down here, but taking chances on people, which is the most satisfying thing. Like, I don't know for you guys, like when I was like 15, I always had this feeling of like, someone just needs to give me a chance. Like I'm a dog to a bone. I just need the opportunity. And no one ever gave me that chance. No one ever saw that in me. So I had to start my own business. And I've had this experience a few times where I've taken a crazy chance on someone. Like, have I told you guys about how I met my business partner, Chris?
No.
So maybe like 2 years into business, I am a bank balance accountant. So like you, Sean, I don't do bookkeeping. I don't understand what's going on. I don't know how to pay taxes. I would just look at the bank account. And if the bank account was bigger on day 30 than it was on day one, I thought I was winning. And one day I go into the bank and I'm trying to get a corporate credit card. And the teller says, oh, you need to go talk to Mr. Sparling. He'll fill out all the forms for you. And so I go into the back of the bank and I get welcomed into this nice office. And Mr. Sparling looks like the son of Mr. Sparling. He's like this little skinny 23-year-old. And we start chatting and immediately just hit it off with this guy. We're joking around and talking about our days and our lives and stuff. And after I was done doing this, I go like, hey, what's your deal? Like, what, you know, do you want to stay at the bank? Like, what are you doing? And he goes, well, I'm thinking about getting my accounting designation or something like that. I don't really know. And I just blurt out, do you want to be my CFO? And he's kind of taken aback and he's like, hey, like, let's go get a coffee tomorrow. We'll talk about it. And I convince him to come and be my CFO. He has almost no accounting experience. He worked at a bank. On paper, he's like the wrong guy to be a CFO of a business. And at the time, we were doing over $1 million, I think. And he just shows up on day one and I trust him. I give him my social security number, all my information, banking, wires, everything. And Chris is now my business partner of 12 years. He's responsible for a significant amount of everything good that's happened in my career. And he's an incredible person. Now, for every story like that, I have, you know, someone who is terrible and incompetent, ranging from that to fraudulent. But when you do take a chance on someone 1 in 10 times, it pays off big. And so what I've struggled with is not knowing, you know, obviously I don't want to take that level of risk still, but I got to figure out a way to give people chances.
I have a great story on that. I can tell the story of same thing that just happened. I'll give you a good and a bad because they both hit yesterday. And so I'll give you the bad one first. So the bad one, I took a chance on a person who, honestly, I still think this guy's a good guy. I like this guy. I met him working out. So he trained with my trainer. He was like a workout partner. Basically, he came over to our house and worked out with us one day randomly. Nice guy, young guy. And he was like an apprentice plumber at the time. So he's a plumber in training. And with, we had a issue with our 3PL for our e-commerce business, which was like, we had a theft issue at the warehouse that we were working with. And then the owner was kind of like, I don't know. You can't prove that we stole it. I'm like, dude, you have the goods and now they're gone. Like who else stole it except for someone at the warehouse? He's like, let's check the cameras. Oh, don't keep the footage. Sorry. And so I just got so pissed. I was like, we're leaving like fucking tomorrow. And so I was like, all right, we're not using this 3PL anymore. We're going to just do our own warehousing. I didn't know the first thing about warehousing, but I was like, okay, whatever. I don't know. We'll figure it out. So I hastily signed a lease of this like 8,000 square foot warehouse near us. And I was like, all right, I definitely don't want to run this warehouse, but it's like the stuff is coming tomorrow. So we need to find somebody. So I'm working out that day and I'm like, hey, you want to run a warehouse? He's like, what? And I was like, you know, you're kind of like a hardworking blue collar guy. Like, you want to try this? He's like, well, I've never really done anything like this. I was like, don't worry. Like, I'll take a shot on you. And like, you're going to make a bunch of mistakes. That's okay. I understand because you've never done this before. I've also never done it before. Let's figure it out together. And like, you know, you'll learn from this and who knows, like this might lead to a future you want. We had talked about what he might want in the future. Like he wanted to one day own real estate, own his own business. And I go, you know, this could become that. Like if we open up a second warehouse, like we'll buy that one and, you know, you could be a part owner in it. You could run our own in-house 3PL. Like you could fulfill not just our brand, but other brands too. So I had kind of laid out this vision. He was super excited about it. And in my head, I do this thing all the time. Sam, you'll appreciate this. I always imagine the HustleCon talk. This is like a phrase I use all the time. I go, all right, imagine 2 years from now, you're on stage talking about how we growth hacked our way to success. What are the stories we're going to tell? Or like how we survived chaos and like absolute, like, you know, disasters, but still made it. So I always work backwards from like, I imagine telling the story on stage and it just gets me more excited about the current moment. And like, so I was already imagining like this plumber, this like apprentice plumber that we hired that now is this amazing guy. And I'm like imagining all these great things. And it started off good. It was going good. But then like, you know, here we are and, you know, a year later or 9 months later, something like that. And, you know, all of a sudden balls being dropped on a couple things and not really growing at the rate we want to grow in terms of his growth as a leader of that part of the business. but I'm still holding out hope. And then I find out he's kind of like scamming us, like trying to like start his own thing. He like sees us growing and like trying to start his own version of it. And like, you know what? Like, it's okay to be, want to be an entrepreneur and start your own thing. But like, if you do it above board, I'm cool with it. If you're kind of are on company time, company dime, like trying to steal our idea, like that's not cool to me. So anyways, I had this like kind of, that all came to a head yesterday. And I was like, look, this is not working. I guess, you know, like my bet was wrong here. This like my hope that we could help this plumber guy become like this like star, like throw that HustleCon talk away. That's not happening. And I'm feeling kind of bad. And then the afternoon I get a call from this guy, Johnny. And Johnny's a kid who I hired at, I think, age 13 or 14. He called me one day at the office and he goes, hey, is this Sean? I was like, yeah. How'd you get this number? Who is this? He goes, my name's Johnny. I met Pete, who works at your office at the dog park. I go, okay. And he is everything okay with Pete? And he's like, yeah. He said that, you know, I'm in eighth grade and I'm a programmer. And he goes, and I don't know any other programmers. And it's about to be summer. And like, I just want to hang out around other programmers. I've never met one. Can I come hang out at your office this summer? And I was like, how can I say no to that?
Obvious winner.
So I'm like, I'm like, okay, this cold call is a yes. So he shows up and like the idea was he's just going to be over there in the corner. He just wanted to like shadow the environment or like whatever. First day I was like, we're in a meeting. I was like, oh, you know what we should do? We should do this like viral little quiz. We don't have enough people to do it. I was like, hey, Johnny, get in here. Johnny, can you build a website? He's like, yeah. Like he didn't know how to, but he's just like, yeah, I think I could. And I was like, all right, build this today. And he like literally stayed there till midnight that day and like had a version of it working by that night. Probably was under like such an immense amount of pressure now that I look back at it. Probably poor guy, like, you know, aged the guy probably 5 years. So anyways, he just joins us full time as an eighth grader. By 10th grade, it's like Johnny needs to be here full time. Johnny's the man. Johnny's the fucking man. He's like hanging out with a bunch of like old neckbeards like us. And he's like, you know, I want to drop out of high school and I just want to do this. And his mom is so worried about him dropping out. And I like go and I meet with his mom and I'm like, ma'am, he's not dropping out. He's going pro. It's like when LeBron James, he skipped college because he was going pro. He was just that advanced. And like, she was like, okay, if you put it that way, that sounds good. Like, I don't feel bad about my kid anymore. You know, like, okay, if you say so. And so, and then he became when we got acquired, he became the youngest Amazon employee, I think in all of Amazon during the acquisition. And now he's like starting his own. He's, I don't know, 19 or something like that. And he's,
what's this kid's name?
Johnny Dallas. Johnny Dallas. I don't know. I'll pull up his Twitter.
Awesome.
So he has his own startup now. And it's like, he just called me yesterday. He's like, yeah, it's going pretty good. Like, we just got a term sheet from, you know, I guess I probably shouldn't say the firm, but it's like the best VC firm. So he's like, the best VC firm just gave us a term sheet, you know, $38 million post valuation. I was like, Johnny, you know, have you hit puberty yet? What's going on, dude? Like, this is crazy to me. But that was, and I told him, I go, dude, he goes, thanks for just making the time. I go, bro, you don't understand. This is the best feeling I can get. It's like, I feel like I bet on you. You were my personal angel investment. And like, we became friends. And then you're actually doing the thing. You like actually did the thing that I always hope somebody does, which is like, take the opportunity and just fucking run with it and become a superstar. And like, when it happens, it's so worth it. And you're like, all right, I'll do this 10 more times. Even if I whiff 9 more times, if there's another Johnny in there, like this is gold for me.
Totally. There's nothing better than when it does work, but it's so painful when it doesn't, because you're just going like, dude, don't you see this? Right. Like, that guy you gave the opportunity to, you know, he could have owned the business with you and done the real estate and all the other stuff. One question, what were the warning signs that that guy wasn't going to be the guy? Cause Chris has this thing about, he calls it gumption. It's like, if you say to them, hey, ball's in your court, do they follow up within 24 hours? Do they move the ball forward? Do they have pace?
If you, before you even gave me that example, you go, what were the red flags or the bad signs? It was exactly this. During one of the workouts, after we brought him on board, we're still working out together. And I go, dude, here's my vision for you. Like, what's the dream? And he gave me this idea of like, I want to own real estate. And it's like, dude, at the moment you have no pathway to real estate, right? You have like, you're just making enough to live, let alone, and you don't know anything about real estate. So like, you know, he didn't really know his path. And I told him, I said, here's the plan. We're going to open up another warehouse. I want to own real estate. Let's buy it. I'll give you a piece and you run it. And we turn this into a business where you actually are running your own business inside that real estate as our own 3PL. Cause I know that e-commerce is booming. This is a good idea. And I didn't hear from him. Like, he was in the moment. He was like, oh wow, that's awesome. Yeah, that's great. And then there was no follow-up for 3 months. And then I met up with him and he was in the other boat. He goes, yeah, like I wanted to like talk more about that, but I didn't hear from you. And I was like, you didn't hear from me. He's like, you know, I thought maybe you would like, you know, I've really been excited about that. I've been thinking about it. I was Googling some places. I go, bro, if that was me and somebody gives me a window into a life I want, I'm like, knock, knock, knock. Hey, about that thing you said, but you know, here's what I'm planning to do to move the ball forward. Hey, here's a couple links. Hey, I put together a spreadsheet. Hey, I'm making a checklist of like, we can do this if I hit these goals. And like, you got to do the work at that point. And so the biggest red flag was that he didn't follow up on that opportunity. And it's not that he didn't want to, he just didn't know that that's what you're supposed to do. And it wasn't his natural inclination to like, to do that. And I noticed totally. That with Johnny, it's the opposite. It's like, tell Johnny something. If you give him an inch, he'll take a mile type of guy.
He'll text you at 9 o'clock at night and say, hey, check this out. Check out the website I'm working on. This guy that I gave the other opportunity to, obviously I won't share any details about it, but I emailed him and I said, dude, I haven't heard from you in 2 months. What's going on? And he goes, yeah, I redesigned the website. Take a look. And I was like, you should have sent me this on day one when you had a design. Show me there's momentum. Instead, we've lost all this momentum. And yeah, it's crazy. But there's no better high.
I just found another guy like this, and I'll tell you the signs that I'll bet right now this guy's going to be a winner. So this guy's, I didn't know this until I hired him. He's just graduated from college. He's got like a .edu email address. But he had emailed me being like, hey, heard you on the pod talk about something like, you know, you want to do some philanthropy. He goes, here's a better idea. Let's create a micro grant where you give out like whatever it is, some amount of money that's you're cool with. And like write a grant for people who do something. I know you're all about action and making shit happen. So like give it away to people who are going to make shit happen. That's better than charity. It'll feel better for you. So the guy like knows me. He reached out intelligently. He says he's doing the thing. He doesn't pitch his company, which by the way is meant to be, he was trying to start like a micro, like AngelList for grants instead of like startups. It's like a way to quickly spin up like a grant program. And I was like, you got my attention. But I was like, yeah, I'm interested. That sounds like a great idea. Let's whatever. And then he followed up like 10 times in the next like 12 days. He was like, hey, here's three ideas for what your grant could be. Tell me which of those three you like. Just send back the number 1, 2, or 3. Then he's like, hey, I saw your tweet about this other thing. Remember the grant thing? You should do this instead of that. Right. And he just kept following up intelligently each time. So I was like, already like this guy's a winner. And I told him, I go, hey dude, I don't have a ton of time for this grant thing, but like, you're awesome. If you ever want to like do something like, and he was like, no, I want to try this grant thing. Anyways, long story short, like 6 months goes by. He ends up graduating. He takes a job at like I don't want to say which place, but like takes a job at like kind of like a hot startup that we know of. And then I get an email out of the blue 3 days ago. Subject line, I've made an irreversible decision. So another great sign is like his copywriting is good for like a 21-year-old. He knows how to like frame it. He goes, I made an irreversible decision. I quit my job yesterday, even though it was a great job and they offered me whatever. Because I've decided that I want to come work for you and make XYZ happen. He goes, wow. He goes, you know, I have a couple other ideas of what I might do, but you're the top of the list. And, you know, so he makes you feel good, does the flattery thing, says exactly what he would do. He goes, I have two ideas for how I would make the Milk Road better. Let me know if you're down to hear them and I'll send them over. All right. So he baits me. I'm like, yeah, of course. Send the ideas. He sends the ideas. And I just reply. I go, I didn't care about your ideas. I just want to hire you. And now he's working with me and he's already awesome. And we're on day three. So I could tell you this guy, his name's Safwan. Safwan is going to be a winner. And I bet you like 6 months from now, I'm going to be talking about how amazing this guy is.
Dude, so the cool. problem, that's awesome. My problem with all this though, is all three of us, I get so much inbound and I'm like, I'm not in the mood to figure out who's legit and who's not. And also, I don't want to have to train someone. I don't want to have to manage someone at the moment. So are you guys getting exhausted managing people? Are you getting worn out, like having to talk to people all the time and tell them what to do or to give them feedback?
Sean, I would love to know how you do this. You've kind of alluded to it a few times that you have a team helping you kind of manage channels or at least looking at opportunities and stuff. How does that work? Because I have that same problem where people email me ideas all the time and there's nowhere for it to go. There's no one to help.
Yeah, no, that's okay. That's by design. It's like, it's meant to be a bottomless pit of like no reply, but then we like cherry pick interesting things and just like pull it out of that well dripping wet. And we're like, oh, you know, maybe we should reply to this. But basically my version of Chris, right? Your business partner is Chris. Mine is Ben. And basically Ben has the keys. He has my email and he has my Twitter. And that's the two biggest forms of inbound. And basically he's the wall. And it's like, if you can climb the Ben wall, then like you've made it. And like Ben knows what's interesting and what's not. And so like, and that's like one of his main things is like, he gets energy from that. Whereas I kind of like, I lose energy doing it. Like you, Sam, like I don't enjoy doing it. Whereas he's like, oh yeah, this guy sent me this thing. So I checked it out. And then I chatted with him. I'm like, dude, I would never check it out or chat with him. He's like, yeah, that's what I like checking things out. Then if it's cool, then I like to chat with them. And I'm like, yeah, you make it sound normal, but like, dude, I fucking hate doing that. And so, and then he just replies basically as me to them. He sets up the call. And then half the time I don't show up on the call. It's just like, they're like, is Sean coming? And then it's like, Ben's like, nah, it's just me. Go. And like, it's a good filter him. Too. Cause like if they're like, you know, offended by that or whatever, it's probably not going to work. Cause I don't have enough time to dedicate to each individual person. If you're just trying to meet me, that's one thing. Versus if you're trying to like advance your cause, your mission, your project or whatever, then like you'll take help from Ben or anybody, right? Like you shouldn't be like on your high horse about it. So to me, the secret answer is like, it's basically Ben, and Ben knows the tight filter of like what's interesting and what's not, because we are like so in sync with each other, right? We talk all the time about little nuggets or hooks that are interesting. And if you find something, he'll hang it on that hook.
Sam, have you ever explored delegating your email?
Yeah, I've explored it. For some reason, I've not pounced on it like I should, but I probably should do that, shouldn't I? I mean, I miss so many emails that I just don't read.
Chris and I did it about 6 months ago. We started using Front. And so our assistant actually reads all the emails, and it goes into her inbox first, and then she chooses what we need to respond to. So it's like, oh, here's a DocuSign that goes to the general counsel. Here's a venture deal. It goes to the rolling fund.
Yep.
So I don't actually see any of it. And it's really reduced my email by, you know, even though the volume's the same, but for me, it's reduced it by 70%. Because at the end of the day, every single email you have to even archive is like mentally taxing.
My thing is that once after I sold the business, I didn't have a business. So I was like, I couldn't justify having someone, you know, doing stuff. I didn't want to have like a higher burn just for personal reasons. Now that I do have some things brewing, maybe I can actually have cash flow coming in from a business. Then I think, yeah, it's worth justifying it, which is crazy because I don't understand, Sean, how you set all your stuff up, because you got like, it seems like a lot of different things coming in. So your accounting must be horrendous. I mean, it must be a huge headache.
Huge mess. Yeah.
You got to go to the bank and find your CFO.
Yeah. But by the way, that little thing you said, that's so true. I always say this, hire your favorite vendors and your favorite salespeople. So like anytime you have an amazing account, like experience with an account manager or a banker, like I had this one woman who helped me with my mortgage, and I was like, hey, if you ever want to like switch careers, like, you're amazing. And like, same thing with like, you know, my trainer, different people. I'm like, yo, you have this like great way with people. Or like the guy who manages our rolling fund, he's like, he works at AngelList, but this motherfucker handles like such a shit. So we'll send him, we'll be like, hey, we're doing this deal. We don't know like half the terms, and it's going to, we have to sign now and wire the money in 3 months.
Is it Connor?
Yeah, Connor.
He's amazing. He's amazing. He's so I don't know how he tracks all this. Yeah, we the same thing. We'll be like, dude, 100K into this. And then like he handles everything. And I'm just like, this is insane.
Connor's an absolute magician. And it's so funny that you have the same guy, because he is so on top of it. And I'm just like, Connor, you are like I need to basically like, as soon as I have enough operational shit to deal with, I'm like, Connor's the first call, because this guy handles the messiest, most disorganized thing. And he's just like, yep, got it. Never makes me feel bad about it. He just like solves the problem. And if he needs something, he tells me and then I give it to him. Like, it's so nice when you find somebody like ultra competent like that.
It's Four Seasons service, right? I don't know if you guys have gone to you go to a Four Seasons and you say, oh, like you say something fussy, like, oh, I want, you know, a thinner blanket. And at some hotels they grumble, and there they just say, oh yes, we would love to, sir. And I feel like, and then they'll never complain or anything. And I feel like, Connor is one of those people, and my assistant is one of those people. Those people are just, they're amazing. When you find one, you just gotta,
I'll tell you one more signal. Along. Somebody who thinks bigger than you, especially if they aren't the one in charge of the company. This is super rare. It just happened. Safwan did this. So I brought him in to work on the Milk Road NFT projects. Like, we're going to launch an NFT as part of Milk Road. We're brainstorming what it could be. And we don't want to just do some bullshit thing. We want it to be like really great. And he was like, it was like his first or second day. And he just goes, you know, just a thought, like, right now we kind of think of this as like some sub little project, like a cool add-on to the Milk Road. He's like, but there's no reason this shouldn't be like as big as Bored Ape Yacht Club or anything else. Like, this could be one of the biggest, best NFT projects around. I just want to say that out loud because, like, I don't want to limit that. And I was just like, you know, if you can make me feel like a little bitch, then, like, you are my favorite employee, right? Because I'm like, oh, yeah, if I'm not thinking sufficiently large enough or aggressive enough about either a timeline or a size of the prize, that's the, you know, that's my favorite type of person to work with, is somebody who pushes my thinking on, like, couldn't we do this faster or couldn't we do this bigger? Because that's normally, like, normally people will just accept whatever the leader sets as the frame. They'll just set that as this invisible walls around how good or how big or how fast something can be. And somebody who breaks those walls is like a winner.
Dude, Sean, how much more hyped are you around Milk Road than some of your other things? It seems like this is the way most hyped you've been. Like, it feels good. So you're 33. It's taken you of 33 years to finally find the thing where it's like, this is what I should be doing. Like, it's ikigai. It's like what you're good at, what the world wants, what the world's willing to pay for, and like what you're passionate about. Right in the middle, you've seemed like you've found that. Whereas before, you found things that made money, but it was like, it's kind of interesting. Then you found things that you're passionate, it didn't really make money. Now you're in the center.
Yeah, I think that's true. Maybe the podcast is also a good example of that. But on that note, you have this thing called Five Pillars of Happiness. What are the What are the five pillars?
This is funny. Right? So Chris has all these shticks and stuff, but one of them is Sparling's Five Pillars of Happiness, and it's very simple, but I think it's really apt.
He learned these at the bank,
and he counts them out for you. So he'll say, see family every day, right? Obviously. See friends and loved ones multiple times a week, be in nature once a week, new and novel experiences once a month, and then feel like a man or a woman, go out with your buddies, go hunting, sports, whatever makes you feel tough and gritty and ticks that box for your caveman brain once a quarter, right? And it's like kind of this very simple model. We built this little circle of it where you can rank yourself on it. But I was like, this is actually like kind of a thing. I feel like more people should use this system.
Sam does it in the reverse. He sees his family once a quarter, and every day he does his caveman shit.
Nice. You're doing it right.
I do think that's it's kind of interesting. Sean, do you do any caveman stuff?
Yeah, for sure. The workout is that. I play sports. I'll play basketball. I compete. I think that's kind of like the version of that. And then sometimes I'll just do like manual labor. I'll just like be like, okay, I'm going to fucking assemble this thing that's been sitting here. Like, it's not the most manly thing, but it's like,
right,
you know, something I don't really need to do. And I'm just going to like just put my full focus into using my hands and like trying to like make something or build something or do something. But that's more
it's,
rare.
It's so weird. Like I have a trainer. I do powerlifting as well. And it's so funny. Like you're basically paying someone to come to your house to have you simulate doing labor.
Doing real right? work. Yeah.
And it's amazing. Like I always feel, you know, my happiest in the hour after my workout or whatever. And you just go, oh, even that's caveman brain, right? You would have been building a log cabin or doing something manly. And now we're so pathetic that we have to pay other men to have simulate that for us in our houses. Right. But yeah, and it's like, caveman brain stuff too.
So
you do boxing, Sam, right?
I got into boxing.
Does that for me. BJJ, if you've ever done jiu-jitsu, it's like wrestling. They're like so primal and like such a good feeling when you're done.
Boxing has been awesome. I love like fighting. I think it's awesome. It's in a controlled environment. It's badass. And that's awesome. And then I'm at this ranch now and I have been so happy. Like I'm trying to figure out how to build a fence and I'm not literally going to build a fence, but like, I'm like having to like move stuff to, you know, you're doing a little bit of work to like figure out how is this going to work or, you know, where we're going to put a pool, just like shit like that. I have found to be so much more rewarding than internet stuff. The problem is that internet stuff is still also awesome and makes so much more money with so little effort compared to like having to construct a pool. I think it's cool to have both.
I feel like you're similar to me in that you're looking for shortcuts. You want to delegate everything, you know, everything's DoorDashed, assistants, chef, you know, all that stuff. Right. I'm the exact same way. And I did this thing where I did I had a psychologist do a 360 on me. I heard about this. One of my favorite investors, this guy, Monish Pabrai, did this thing where he hired a psychologist to basically write an operating manual and say, here's what you're missing in your life. Here's the brutal feedback your friends and family have about you. Here's how you need to improve. And so I heard this on a podcast. How much did that cost? I was driving. I think it was 10 grand. And so he spent like 4 hours interviewing me. We did a whole bunch of testing. And then he talked to like my six, I think it was three friends and family members and three people I work with. And I got it back and it was absolutely one of the most brutal experiences of my entire life. Like our brains are not, or we're not designed to know what our friends say about us and stuff. But one of the key things he said to me is he goes, it's almost like all of your friends have come to you and said, Andrew, on Saturday, let's mow the lawn together. And then afterwards, we're going to celebrate and we're going to have a cold beer. So we're all going to sit in a circle and, you know, be all sweaty and pop a Corona or whatever. And I just say, nah, it's cool. I just got a guy on TaskRabbit and he's going to do that. So I never get the sense of satisfaction of doing the work. And I never get the camaraderie of doing it with anyone. And you're right. You're right. It is doing real labor. That was the feedback. And I was like, holy shit, that's so true. And Sean, I feel like you're probably similar.
Yeah, except it's my wife telling me at all times to go fucking do the work instead of like hiring a man to come hang, you know, to like literally like hang a poster on my wall, which, by the way, I've done.
Me and my wife, one of our biggest fights over the last couple of years was I didn't like wheeling the garbage out to the street because we'd always be like 10 o'clock at night. Same. I'd be in my boxers, you know, and I finally was like, oh, there's a private garbage service. They'll take all of our recycling. This is awesome. My wife looked at me like I had just like, you know, I didn't defend her in a physical fight or something. It was like, I lost all respect. My wife like wouldn't have sex with me for weeks. It's not good.
She gave you that Jada Smith look.
Exactly. Yeah. Except I didn't slap anyone. I just cowered.
Dude. That's why Will did it. Will's like, oh, fuck. Yeah. This is the moment. I can get out of the doghouse about the trash right now.
Exactly. But the worst pain is when you like hire a cleaning lady or something and I see her like try to like move the trash can down the thing and it's like heavy. I'm like, oh, fuck. I can't. Come on. Just move. I got it. It's all good. Like, you got to feel that guilt.
It's so fascinating. It's so fascinating, though, to think about, like, we do so little labor compared to someone 75 years ago. And there's a value. If you grew up in a farming family, your parents would think you're pathetic if you don't grow your own vegetables. Right. So it's like, where do you end? Where, you know, what's the right amount of labor and what's the wrong amount? Because I also know people who they're wealthy and yet they spend all their time doing miserable tasks they hate, you know, cleaning the cat's litter box, taking out the garbage. And I'm like, hey, just delegate this, hire someone. And they hate it. You know, they're fighting with their wife over it. They, you know, it's miserable. So I think there's a balance.
Dude, you didn't need to spend the $10K. You could have just asked your cleaning lady. Nobody knows you better than your cleaning lady and or your, you know, a nanny or somebody like that. Like they know you better than anybody.
My cleaning lady doesn't speak English. I actually have to, I text her in Spanish. So she doesn't know anything. At least that's what I think. Maybe she's actually a spy or something.
She knows where you leave your underwear on the floor and shit like that. She knows how long that cup will sit on your desk before you just finally take it to the sink. She knows everything.
All right, bros, I got to bounce. I have someone here, but are you guys going to keep talking?
No, we can wrap it. It's cool.
Yeah, that was fun.
It won't be the same without you. All right, let's wrap it up. Ben, what'd you think?
Making me come on camera here on my sick day, but great stuff. Always a great episode from Andrew. I anticipate this is going to be one of our top download ones. It usually is.
Awesome. Ben, I said that we crossed 100K per episode. That was like only for a handful, or what do you know what the numbers are? They just
what
mentioned
it. What is our actual average? Like, what's our actual average?
I don't know the actual
60, 100?
But it depends what window you're looking at. If it's, I think most people measure it by a 60-day window.
Yeah, whatever. 30, 60 is fine.
All right, let me just pull up the stats.
Have you guys considered like building in public and having a graph or something? Or would that
kind of do? I tweeted out.
It starts going down. Yeah, I know you talk about it a lot.
Our March numbers, I tweeted out, it was 1.6 million, whatever the number, it was something like that. That includes YouTube, though. That includes only people who watch full YouTube videos as opposed to just the clips. If you add in the clips, yesterday, Sean, your video about LeVar Ball, I don't even know anything. They made fun of me all in the comments because I don't know who these people are. It got 400,000 views in like 24 hours or something like
that. 400. On what?
You realize one of your videos right now on YouTube, YouTube Shorts has like millions and millions of views.
What?
Yeah, no, bro. Dude, it's got like thousands of comments and people just roasting me and a little bit of you.
It literally yeah, that's it, the it has going, tens of millions of views.
Getting famous on tens of millions of views YouTube sucks.
Does it really have tens of millions of views?
Yeah.
You just get bullied by like 14-year-olds if you.
Yeah, and they're all way better looking. They all wear Vans.
I got super excited about our TikTok videos. I was like, oh, sick, a million views. They're probably saying how useful and helpful this content was, right? Can you open up the comments thing? It's just it's not nothing good in the comments for us, right? Like, you know, I'm hairy, ugly, and dumb, and you're like, you know, I don't know. I don't know what they say about you. I was just too focused on me.
What? All right.
Ben, you want to know the numbers? So I think what you were talking about was the other day. It's for the first time we have YouTube videos with... We have multiple YouTube videos with over 200,000 views, which is good. And these are not like the short TikTok style videos, like actual videos with a couple hundred thousand. In terms of just podcast, our top downloaded episode is at 70,000.
But for what date range? All time?
Just all time. Really? But if you throw in YouTube, it crosses 100,000.
So how much of your growth has come from doing all that TikTok stuff where you're like, oh, we'll give out, I forget, you're giving out money or something like that for the person who takes stuff viral?
It's hard to say. Yeah. It's like, I mean, that definitely worked. But we were doing other stuff at the same time. So it's hard to say how much of that came from that.
Oh, hey, when are you guys doing the summit? What's the deal with that?
I don't know, but can I read you the top five comments on that video that has 3 million views on YouTube? This is exactly what I'm talking about. All right, here's comment number one. This is what people say when they just read the headlines. That comment has 6,000 likes. Number two, there's a guy in the NBA. That alone told us everything. He has no clue what he's talking about. Okay, fair enough. Know a lot about the NBA. This guy reminds me of myself in college when I was giving a talk about a topic the professor taught, and I'd only skim reading 10 minutes before the class. That has 2,000 likes. Please stop covering sports. All of this information is either wrong or in the wrong series of events. Okay.
Damn. All right. I got to go. I'll talk to y'all soon.
All right, this episode is brought to you by Mercury. They are the finance platform of choice for over 200,000 companies. Shouldn't be surprised because I use it myself for not one, not two, but I have 8 different Mercury accounts. I have 7 for different companies that I'm a part of, and then I have my own personal account because now they have personal banking, which is a really cool feature. I highly, highly recommend it. Like I said, I use it myself. And the reason why is because the way that Mercury works is beautiful. It's very intuitive. And you could tell that it's actually made by a startup founder. It's an entrepreneur. You could tell it's made by somebody who used other banking products in the past and didn't like all the different rough edges and annoyances and decided to, you know, actually fix it himself. And really, any type of entrepreneur you are, let's say you're an agency, well, one of the things every agency has to do is be able to send invoices, easily create them, send them to customers, and stay current on your balances with all your customers. Well, you can do that inside Mercury. And so I think that Mercury is great. Highly recommend you check it out. And thank you for sponsoring the show. For more information, check out mercury.com. Mercury is a financial technology company, not a bank. Check show notes for details.